Okay, we'll only get a half hour launch into this topic, but at least I think we should do so. Race and class. Another, you know, really interesting and perplexing domain. The analysis of race itself is difficult, and then understanding its intersection with class is also difficult. There's a tendency in some critics, some traditions of radical theory, to kind of treat all forms of inequality, which are the object of our critical gaze, as essentially symmetrical. You know, you encounter lists of these things: sexism, racism, classism, ageism, heterosexism. There are some forms of oppression which don't have convenient names. There's a strong disability rights movement in the United States. Disabilities is certainly a source of considerable disadvantage of an exclusionary character, which I think is appropriately described as oppression. We don't have disableism. You know, there's not a... What?
Ableism.
It just doesn't. It doesn't. It hasn't caught on as a, you know, as a way of capturing this. I know around issues of body weight, there's a serious question. It's absolutely unquestionable that there are significant forms of discrimination, especially against women, based on body weight. And so there's plenty of oppressions, right? So there's a tendency sometimes to treat this as a kind of laundry list. Now, in some respects, I think that's completely legitimate. That is, I think in terms of the issue of lived experience and identity of people, there's no reason to regard a priori any form of oppression as, quote, worse than any other, or less worse. That is, there's no reason to create an a priori moral hierarchy or existential hierarchy across these forms of oppression. It's entirely possible, indeed I think likely, that certain forms of physical disability loom largest in people's self-understanding of how they fit into the world and where the obstacles to them living flourishing lives lie, in terms of lived experience. And in terms of the moral imperative to do something about a form of oppression, it can certainly be the case that doing something about a severe form of oppression centered around disability in a given society could be much more pressing than around sexuality or age or class or race. You know, it just depends. It all depends. So I think on the one hand, this laundry list kind of approach where you just have a list of oppressions and you don't order it in any way is fine. Nevertheless, I don't think the laundry list approach is a satisfactory one for social theory, for our kind of social science and explanations that we want to build. Not because I want to assign a priori priority to one or another, but I think it tends to obliterate the question of specificity, to understand the distinctiveness of the causal processes bound up with each of these forms of oppression. And that's really what we have to grapple with as from the point of view of an emancipatory social science. We want to understand what are the causal processes that are distinctive to any given form of oppression, or to say it slightly differently, any distinctive obstacle to the conditions for human flourishing, since that's our normative grounding, or at least my normative grounding for an emancipatory social science. We want to understand the specificity of these mechanisms. We want to understand how they interact with each other in the world. And all of that is stage setting for understanding how to transform those conditions. Now, it's not always the case, of course, that you have to understand the specificity of a mechanism to know what you have to do to transform it. Sometimes you can treat the mechanisms as black boxes and still know what to do to transform it. As I've, I think, alluded to the simple-minded example, aspirins can reduce headaches without knowing what the mechanisms that generate the headaches are. But nevertheless, our advance in the scientific understanding of analgesics and what will work best for which sorts of people will be aided by knowing what generates headaches and how it is that aspirin affects those processes. All right, that's a kind of first point, background point. This is then by way of introducing what's a really tricky problem. What is the specificity of racial oppression? What is it that justifies calling a particular form of social division a racial division, as opposed to some other kind of division? There's lots of different sorts of social division in society, some of which are benign, some of which create sharp inequalities, some of which create huge oppressions. There's lots of different social divisions. What is it that renders, from a theoretical point of view, from the concepts that we have, a division as racial? This is a kind of foundational methodological point. What does it mean to identify the theoretical specificity of any concept, but in this case, the theoretical specificity of a form of social division? This involves a number of different tasks: specifying the abstract category of which racism would count as a specific type. So you need some very abstract category of social division, and then racism is one instance of it. Within the abstract category, specifying what is it that distinguishes racism as a subtype from others? What's the difference between racial oppression and, or racial division and ethnic division? Race and ethnicity often get paired. Is this just because we're being sloppy and don't want to take a stand on the distinction? Or is there really a distinction between race and ethnicity? Are these distinct forms of social division which may contingently overlap strongly? And then once we get that theoretical stuff sorted out, we can then look at empirical, historical, concrete cases and see which ones are and are not instances of racial oppression. Now, this seems like just a taxonomic label-mongering exercise, and sometimes it ends up seeming incredibly pedantic. But if the concepts identify distinct kinds of mechanisms, and if the distinct kinds of mechanisms are telling us how in the world this process works, at least tells us something about it, then there are real stakes involved in calling something a form of racial oppression as opposed to something else. In 2003, there was a very salient historical example of this. The UN Conference on Racism, there was a resolution proposed by a number of delegations that Zionism is a form of racism. Zionism is a form of racism. Now, many people thought this was absurd. One reaction was, what? That's ridiculous. They thought this was a kind of theater of the absurd to say Zionism was a form of racism. Others regarded it as capturing some deep underlying theoretical unity between Zionism and other forms that were more generally regarded as racism. For example, some people thought there was a deep affinity between the Afrikaner racism against Africans in South Africa during the apartheid era, a deep affinity between that form of racism and Zionism. They were both connected to a colonial settlement regime. They both involved territoriality and exclusion. They both involve Bantustans, in effect, walled, separated zones where some people could live and others not. They were both, in the Afrikaner case, bound up with religion. The Afrikaner's self-understanding of as the chosen people of God, that was part of Afrikaner myths as well. The great Afrikaner myth of Blood River, where they defeat a hardy band of Afrikaners defeated 10,000 Zulus. That is an origins myth of the founding of the Afrikaner state, which provides a lot of the symbolic apparatus that reinforced the apartheid version of racism there. So for a lot of people, these seem like very similar phenomena. And for others, it seemed completely absurd. So this can be an arbitrary exercise of wordplay for political purposes. I think in the case of the Zionism debate, it was primarily a political ploy. regardless of what we decide theoretically about it, to explain why in 2003 did a number of delegations put on the table the resolution, Zionism is a form of racism. It doesn't matter whether it is or isn't. The reason for doing it was an attempt at tying the Israeli regime in with a set of universally condemned practices as a way of delegitimating the Israeli project, right? So there's no question that that's the political motive. And from that point of view, it was of marginal relevance whether there was deep sociological grounding for the claim that Zionism is a form of racism. I hope that this discussion isn't mainly about wordplay, but is really about trying to understand what the theoretical specificity is. Okay, the theoretical specificity of racism. And, of course, the theoretical specificity of racism also is bound up with the theoretical specificity of the category race. This immediately bumps us up against the problem of what's called essentialism. This is another methodological complication of this kind of classification exercise. The theoretical specificity of a particular concept depends on how it figures in some theoretical problem. You know, you give theoretical specificity to a concept because you're trying to explain something. It's trying to fit this concept into some broader question. To argue that a particular category has a particular definition, irrespective of its theoretical purpose, is what some people call the sin of essentialism. But I think more often it's just sloppy thinking. I think it's important to be careful in your critiques of various theoretical positions. A lot of theory is just sloppy. People just haven't thought through all the implications of what they're doing. And they're glib, they're sloppy, they take concepts off the shelf without really worrying about them. And that doesn't mean that they're committed to an essentialist view.
Could you repeat the definition of essentialism quick?
Well, I'm saying that if you say this is what race means, irrespective of any question or problem you're trying to study, then it sounds like you're saying it's a kind of essence of the situation that this is what race is, as opposed to this is how we are going to understand race with respect to an explanatory problem where we're identifying a set of causal mechanisms. Two things should be classified together if it is the case that they identify the same kind of causal process within some social phenomenon under investigation. Then you should classify them together. It may turn out, when you push this, that some common sense everyday distinctions dissolve, and other things which look very similar on the surface may be very different. That is, it may turn out that Zionism and racism in common sense seem very different. One is generated by a set of religious identities forged in the crucible of European ethno-religious history and the Holocaust and late 19th century projects of national identity formation. And that seems very different from American racism forged in the crucible of slavery. Right, so those look very different. It may be that things that look very different turn out to be actually the same, but it also can be that with respect to explanatory problems, things that look similar may turn out to actually be really quite different phenomena. For theoretical purpose, different kinds of conceptual lines of demarcation and aggravations need to be drawn for different purposes. So, ultimately, the issue is not so much which of these get the tag racial oppression. There may be historical and linguistic reasons to use this label quite narrowly. We might want to, for example, restrict racial to those cases where there are observable phenotypical differences between people that are identified as races. Now, that would be a very narrow definition of race, because it would mean that one shouldn't describe the Nazi treatment of Jews as racism, because there weren't phenotypical differences that were easily identifiable between Jews and non-Jews. There were plenty of blonde, blue-eyed Jews. Right. So there were descent rules that defined who is and who isn't a Jew, but there weren't phenotypical. So if we take that really narrow definition, then some things which everybody would call racism wouldn't count as racism. All right, all of this is to kind of set the stage for now. Let's begin to grapple with it. What's the abstract category within which race is a particular instance? Now, I like quite a lot the proposal by Michael Albert and Robin Hanel on this question, which I believe was one of the assigned readings for this section. It's not a standard way of thinking about this, but I think it's actually a pretty interesting one. So this is not a definition of race. It's a definition of the more abstract category of which race is one form. Racism and race would be one form of this more abstract category. The more abstract category which they propose centers around the problem of community or communal identity. So here's the basic idea of Albert and Hanel. At the very core of social life is the problem of community. And by community, they mean the circle of people with which one regularly cooperates and feels bonds of trust and solidarity. So imagine, let's take the word community, as the circle of people with whom you have a kind of default position of trust and solidarity and willingness to cooperate in all sorts of ways. Cooperation includes just willingness to be friendly on the street rather than be fearful of. Right? So it's the circle of people who are, quote, like you in this salient respect. You're in community with them. This notion of community identifies one of the basic building blocks of social life and reciprocity. In Albert and Hanel's view, there are a variety of such building blocks. One is family. That's a core form of social interaction bound up with biological reproduction. That's what they see as the centerpiece of family. Then there is work, the forms of essential cooperation to transform nature to produce means of subsistence. And sociability is another building block, community. Communal identity refers to the criteria one uses to decide what sorts of people fall into this category and what sorts don't. One can have multiple communal identities, of course. There's no reason, it's not the case that you can have only one. You can have many. Your life can be embedded in shifting, fluid, open-ended, porous boundaries. It doesn't have to be a binary at all. And you can be embedded in a variety of communities which have potentially contradictory characters to them, too. Okay, so defined in this way, community and community identity need not apply anything about oppression. It just implies circles of trust, cooperation, and sociability. It does imply something about there being people outside that boundary, but it doesn't mean that you bear a relationship of hostility to the people outside the boundary. It's just that you don't share this sense of solidarity, trust, and cooperation. They're not part of your circle of cooperation. Now, in ordinary life, I think we all can make sense of this. And we know, in a contemporary, modern, American-type society, there are circles of people that constitute our community of solidarity in this, you know, specific kind of sense. And there are people outside of it who we don't hate. We're not out to get them. We don't feel they're out to get us. They're just not included in the people who we would automatically trust and feel support for and come to the rescue of and feel solidarity with. Right? So stated at this way, there's nothing malevolent or oppressive about the specification. How do they go from this very positive notion affirming a building block of society, of all societies. This is sort of foundational to social life. How do you get from there to racism? What's the bridge? I think the way I would frame it, which is not exactly the terms they do, I would want to call the key mechanism that connects this to domination and exploitation and exclusion a problem of what could be called an alienated form of community, as opposed to just community. So just as we could call class relations an alienated form of the division of labor needed for cooperative production under conditions of complexity, there's going to be different roles, different tasks. There has to be cooperation and coordination among them. An alienated form of such cooperation is class relations, where the cooperation is exercised under conditions of domination and exploitation. An alienated form of community is one that transforms the raw material of sociability within a circle of trusted, a category of people with whom one has as the default position, at least minimal trust, turning that into forms of exclusion, in which then the solidarities can become the basis for domination, not just mutual help. Communal identities can be a form of what could be even called alienated solidarity, you know, solidarity that gets used for purposes of domination rather than solidarity that gets used just for purposes of reciprocity. Ethnicity, religion, language, nationality, tribe, all of these forms of communal identity can, in certain situations, be alienated in this way and become sources of communal division, antagonism, and oppression. Right, so all of these, language can be the basis of communal identity. Ethnicity, for sure, can be. In the Balkans, in the Yugoslav case, when the Yugoslavia dissolved, the distinction between Serbs and Croats. Right, so Serbs and Croats, these are two, and Bosnians for that matter. Serbs, Croats, and Bosnians all speak the same language. Their language is identical. You can't tell one from another. There's absolutely zero physical, they're all Slavs. There's no difference whatsoever between them, physically. The difference between Serbs, Croats, and Bosnians is strictly Catholic, Eastern, Orthodox, Muslim. It is no more, as it were. I mean, it is more, but it's basically, if you're a Southern Slav and you're a Catholic, you're a Croatian. If you're a Southern Slav and you're Eastern Orthodox, you're a Serbian. If you're a Southern Slav and you're Muslim, you're a Bosnian. In some parts of Croatia and Serbia, 40% of households were intermarried between Serbs and Croats because nobody gave a damn about the difference between Catholic and Eastern Orthodox. They, you know, it would be the equivalent in the United States, you know, of a Presbyterian and a Methodist marry. You know, you were raised in these different families. It wasn't an identity that said, don't marry that person. It's a degradation. It was just these religions and religious heritages were just, and this Bosnian-Serbian stuff was just seen as historical legacies. So there were regions where there was very strong, high levels of interaction and good feelings. And then the breakup of Yugoslavia occurs. Not in those regions, but in other regions, there were what could be called ethnic entrepreneurs who saw that they could gain political leverage by mobilizing around these ancient ethnic identities and treating them not just as forms of cultural, shared cultural tastes and of religious affiliation, but as forms of antagonism. And then the strategy was basically to have acts of terrorism committed against the other ethnic groups so as to create a differential of trust and security. Right? So in the context of the huge unraveling of the social structure and the sense that you know, we're scared. I mean, there are people killing each other. Who could you trust? Well, if you were a Croat, you felt you could trust other Croats more than you could trust Serbs, because there were Serbs, there were minority, violent, extremist Serbs who were killing Croats, and vice versa. In the areas with this high density of intermarriage, there was a very concerted effort to resist this. There were militias of joint Serbs and Croats together to keep the violent nationalists out of small towns, and to try to patrol and to create a solidarity against this unraveling. But the, you know, the pressures were just huge. And, you know, it's just an unbelievable episode of social disintegration in the face of mobilization around antagonism rather than just solidarity, that creates small gradients of trust, not so small maybe, but real gradients of trust variation across that boundary. And that then becomes the basis for mobilizing for oppression. So the fracturing of trust along an ethnic boundary is something that gets produced by social action. And in a context where people just were blindsided, you know, especially in these regions of Croatia where there was such a high level, such a secularization, such a shedding of the ethnic heritage, and such a sense of interconnectedness. I mean, in the U.S., historically, of course, the Catholic-Protestant divide had that character in some parts of the world. It still does in Northern Ireland. It doesn't in the U.S. There's lots of Protestant-Catholic intermarriage, right? So you can imagine what would happen if in some region of the country there were Catholic militias out to shoot Protestants. I mean, it would, you know, people's sense of what's going on in the world would just go haywire. Now, I don't think there's a latent reservoir of communal identity rooted to that religious divide in the U.S. that it could actually be successfully mobilized to create this kind of reciprocity and solidarity barrier. I can't see it, frankly. But, you know, surprises do happen. Anyway, the question, racial division then, is one form of such communal division. Our next task, which is what we're going to start with on Monday, our next task is to figure out, well, what is it that gives the racial division as a form of communal division its specific bite? What is it that renders it different from a religious division or a purely ethnic division? Or a nationalist division. There's other forms of division, also rooted in communal identity. Race is one that has a particular logic to it. And that's what we'll start with on Monday.
Eric, there's also, at least this is what I was told, recently Croatia has